You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. I'm Darrell West, Vice President and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution, and I would like to welcome you to this forum on distance learning. Technology has shown the ability to improve education by improving access and by personalizing the educational experience. In the case of distance learning, technology connects geographically disparate students with instructors, allowing for a richer variety of learning opportunities. But as a fairly recent trend in American education, there is much to be understood about distance learning. For example, how does it work? How does it affect students, teachers, and the learning process? What are the early evaluation studies showing? And what are the policy aspects that need to be addressed? To discuss these and other topics, we have put together a distinguished set of speakers. Elaine Allen is an associate professor of statistics and entrepreneurship at Babson University. She is research director for the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor Project and co-director of the Babson Survey Research Group. Through that survey group, Dr. Allen co-authors the annual Sloan Report on Online Education in the United States, and she has published widely on survey research, entrepreneurship, and online education. Louis Sorys is the director of the Postsecondary Education Program at the Center for American Progress. He brings more than 15 years of private, nonprofit, and public sector experience and expertise to education, adult literacy, and workforce development. Prior to joining the Center for American Progress, he served as the director of business development at the Rhode Island Economic Development Corporation, and he is co-author of a paper with Clay Christensen of a paper on disrupting college, which he'll talk a little bit about today. Richard Garrett is a managing director at EduVentures. He leads its continuing and professional education learning collaborative and its online higher education learning collaborative. These are membership programs for institutions seeking to grow their adult and online enrollment and determine what the programming trends are, consumer demand, school positioning, and operational strategies in this area. Prior to joining EduVentures in 2005, Richard was deputy director of the Observatory on Borderless Higher Education in the United Kingdom. His publications include Benchmarking Online Operations, Online Higher Education Market Update, and Competing in an Online Higher Education. So I have asked each of these to briefly summarize his or her perspective on distance learning and what each of them thinks we need to do in order to move forward. So, Elaine, I know you've been working on online education for a number of years and have done these annual studies. What do you see happening in this area, and what do you think we need to do?
Okay, so we have surveyed over the last 9 years all the schools of higher education in the U.S. In terms of responses, we've heard from about 69% of all schools that represent 89% of all enrolled students in higher education. We've seen growth over the past 9 years, double-digit growth every year. And we see particular areas of interest. First, if you look at where is it growing the most, well, it's growing the most in the community college area. When he mentioned this is distance learning, where are the students coming from? Schools have started in online education because they wanted to expand their student base. Most students live within 50 miles of the school they're taking the online course at. We looked over the last 2 years, especially at the economic downturn, and we found that we saw a bump in the demand for online education in courses and programs. At the same time, in mostly public universities, which is where most of the online students are taking courses, there's budget pressure. They don't have the money to expand. The only schools that had budget increases over the last 2 years in online were the for-profit colleges. And that sort of opens a little can of worms here because there is a lot of discussion on quality, both quality of online versus face-to-face, where we see now a slowly growing, but now about 60% of the chief academic officers that we poll in our survey saying that they believe that online is at least as good as. But if we look at the flip side, and we actually have a recent report, my co-author and co-director of Bath and Survey Research Center is sitting right here, and we just issued a report on private colleges versus everyone else. We found that everyone else thinks the education you get at a for-profit school is 85% of them say it's not as good as a public or non-profit private school. If you ask the for-profits, fully 85% of them say it's as good as. And we are still wondering about the 15% of the people in for-profit who think that it's not as good as. Where do we see things going? We have started to see a small contraction in some program areas, but not in the number of students taking at least one online course. For example, this was the first year we saw a slight contraction in engineering programs that are, and engineering courses that are delivered online. The areas that continue to show highest growth are business and education. I do have, after we're done, a handout that lists all our reports, because we not only study just online, we look at we've just finished a very large study of faculty and social media, as well as this private public looking at opinions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Lewis, you have written a paper on the challenges facing colleges. So what are you seeing?
Sure. So the reason that we decided to write the paper was that as we started having, in the last 4 or 5 years or so, perhaps I would, you might loosely argue since the Spellings Commission report, you've seen policymakers in D.C. struggling with the idea of, okay, what's accountability mean in higher ed broadly? You know, as we were moving from an access and affordability agenda, which basically started with the Higher Ed Act and helping people access college by making it more affordable through different means, grants and loans, and we started moving towards accountability, I noticed when I would go up to the Hill in particular and talk to people on the Hill that we were having trouble seeing through to the solution, is what I call, it's like, so if a bachelor's degree could be 30% less, what does that mean? How would you do that? And as we looked around for ways to think about that, I reached out to Clay Christensen, having just read the book that he had written on K-12 education, Disrupting Class, and asked him if he had an interest in co-authoring this paper to apply disruptive innovation theory, this theory that he developed that looked at how markets change and how technology and business models in a market can radically transform and does radically transform the delivery of the product or service in that market. And so we did. And essentially what we posited was there are two core things that you need for disruptive innovation to change a market. One is a scalable technology. And we posit in the paper that online education is that scalable technology in higher ed, and a way to articulate a business model that allows that technology to scale. And we didn't write the paper as kind of like the end of a conversation. We wrote it as the beginning of a conversation to give us an understanding of how higher ed could be transformed through technology and what the policy implications might be. So that's what we did.
Okay. Thank you very much. Richard, you are the managing director at EduVentures. So what's your perspective on distance learning?
Thank you. At EduVentures, we work with most of the major online players in higher education. And by that, I mean colleges and universities that offer wholly online programs. The Sloan C survey tracks anyone taking one or more course online. We focus on the subsection of that, people taking the vast majority of all of their higher education online. And so we work with the vast majority of the major for-profit schools in the online space, University of Phoenix and so on, and a long, diverse group of non-profit institutions that have turned to online for various reasons to grow, to scale, to innovate. The theme of this panel is to what extent can distance learning transform U.S. education, and I'll focus my comments on higher education. I think it's been undeniably transformative in terms of access. If you look at the group in the U.S. population that has embraced online at program level as opposed to course level, it's primarily adult students, meaning students over the age of 23, over the age of 25. Over the last 10 years, we've seen dramatic increases in participation among those age groups. and that's primarily driven by the availability of provision through online higher education. If we look at some other metrics of innovation or transformation, I think online is still to prove its case. So in terms of affordability, online certainly made higher education more accessible insofar as you can more easily combine work and study, but it's had no clear contribution to lowering the cost of development or delivery. It's typically, most schools have priced online the same tuition-wise as they have for on-ground, and often additional fees creep in, technology fees and so on, that may reflect additional cost or may just reflect a desire to increase revenue. In terms of outcomes of higher education through distance learning, again, it's a little vague. There's plenty of studies that show, typically on an isolated course level, one school, one period of time, that the quality is essentially the same. And I think delivery modes are pretty weak variable when it comes to quality. Lots of more mundane variables like the nature of the student, the nature of the faculty, the nature of the materials tend to be far more powerful than delivery mode alone. But I think the jury is clearly, I think, decided in terms of online can be perfectly good in terms of quality and outcomes, just as face-to-face can. Equally, both can be bad, and it comes down to some pretty standard teaching and learning practices. But in terms of has online really transformed the student experience that somehow leads to demonstrably superior outcomes, I think the jury is very much still out there. Most online instruction is still pretty rudimentary. It's still rather 1999 in terms of course management systems, text-based chat, and so on. There's a growing margin of multimedia, but it's rather add-on and experimental rather than transformatory right now. And in terms of, you know, has online changed the standard credential, the length of the credential? No, it hasn't. Has it in some clear way demonstrated improved outcomes or time to completion or graduation rates? And I think the problem there is a policy problem insofar as Lewis implied, there's been a lot of emphasis and monitoring around financial aid as a lever, tracking participation as a lever. But in terms of really understanding outcomes, the federal measure is, as you know, full-time, first-time undergraduates, graduating within 6 years for a bachelor's degree, 3 years for an associate degree. That excludes most wholly online students. It excludes most students at the more innovative schools, whether for-profit or non-profit. So there's been a very weak incentive for schools to really monitor the impact of their distance learning innovation. And it may just be too early. We're in an early part of the cycle, and I think the next 10 years will be very significant and telling us to the potential of online to do more than it's currently done. But I think without that clear policy lever on measuring outcomes, regardless of student type, regardless of institutional type, regardless of delivery mode, we're going to remain in this rather vague situation of only really being able to track participation and not anything deeper than that.
Okay. Thank you very much. I want to come back to this issue of quality because several of you have mentioned it in different sorts of ways. For example, Elaine was saying 60% of chief academic officers believe online education is as good as face-to-face. But then Richard is saying the jury is still out on the education impact. Now, we know surveys are more perceptual, so I'd like to get from each of you kind of your view on this quality question, specifically as it relates to online education. What does the evidence suggest in terms of online versus face-to-face, and what do we need to do in that area? Start with Elaine and then go Lewis and Richard.
Okay, so when we ask chief academic officers, we get this result of 60%. If we start talking and asking what are the barriers to having quality, we have done surveys of faculty. And there are certainly an entrenched group of faculty who never want to teach online. Those that do say that the benefits of teaching online are the ability to deliver multi-modes of a lecture. If I'm giving you a lecture, I'm here for an hour and a half. I can only do it one way, perhaps. If I'm doing it online, I can show it in three or four ways, and that would be one of the benefits. Now, chief academic officers being in charge of the academics in their university, we thought they would be more likely to be on the positive side. But there is a group, mostly small private liberal arts colleges, that have always, and there's probably 15% to 20%, always say it will never be as good as. So, and I don't see that changing. Over the 9 years, it's been pretty much a bar, whereas you see some change up to 60%, and then a tiny group at the top that say it's actually better than the face-to-face because of the ability to deliver things in multiple ways.
Lewis, what's your view on the quality of online education?
So we have to start just a little bit broader, if you'll allow me, that we don't know really much about the quality of education, higher education broadly, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure many folks in the room are familiar with Academically Adrift, the most recent text that came out by two, you know, reasonably respected folks that looked at the CLA, the College Learning Assessment, and it demonstrated that, you know, 43% of undergraduates that they studied showed no demonstrable increase in critical thinking or writing skills after 2 years at a four-year school. And so part of what we have to start with is this notion that we've been measuring quality in higher ed based on inputs, number one, and number two, inputs closely aligned with prestige. So think U.S. News and World Report. So when we begin to have the conversation about quality in online education, we're having it in that context, right? And one of the ways that online education, so just to come back to our particular point of view in the paper, a disruptive innovation always starts out as a lower quality because it's not designed to serve the sophisticated customers that consume the existing product. And so it is going to start out low quality. We don't really have a way in public policy of shepherding that kind of innovation in higher ed. In almost no sector do we have that, but we certainly don't have it in higher ed. How do you acknowledge that something's going to be lower quality when it starts out, but regulate it in a way that assumes that it's going to scale up in quality? So that's number one. Number two, we're having the conversation now about outcomes in all of higher ed. In some ways, as I've told many of the for-profits when they talk to me, is that if everything I've seen about their ability to use learning analytics is true, then they actually have an advantage once quality of instruction kicks up online, because they're way ahead, as far as I can tell, of traditional schools on learning analytics or the ability to track students at that kind of individual level.
Okay, Richard?
As Lewis says, I think there's no question that traditional higher education has some quality problems. If you just use the only clear outcomes measure we have, only 57% of people intending to get a bachelor's degree attain that within 6 years nationally. National average, and it's been somewhat stuck there for some time, and we've only tracked it as a nation for the last 20-odd years or so. So I think there's no question that traditional face-to-face can't rest on its laurels and just say, well, everything's perfect here and this online is unnecessary. There's no problem to be addressed. On the other hand, I also think that, as I implied earlier, the notion of is online as good is actually a misplaced question. And online is a set of tools and resources that you can use well or you can use badly. You can use with expertise or you can use naively. Just as face-to-face is understandably familiar, it's tradition-bound, schools are set up entirely around it as a way of delivering content and knowledge, and understandably there's this sense of, well, of course that's the way to do it, and anything else seems different, but history tells us that every innovation gets that kind of reception, and then gradually things change, and I think even for the most, you know, tradition-bound schools or the most place-bound schools, online resources of various kinds are steadily creeping into the mainstream, and you know, in 10, 20 years' time, may look back on today and see a significant difference, even if now the change seems imperceptible. So ultimately, I think online is such a broad, covers such a broad range of things that trying to capture its quality in some sort of yes-no or better or worse, is misplaced. But again, it's inevitable in the early stages of innovation where it just seems like it is this single thing. So I think the more interesting question is how can online technology start to do more than it's currently done? How can some of the more, you know, immersive simulation-type experiences become more turnkey, easier for faculty to use, cheaper to develop and scale up? And again, it's still a question, I think, but can that really start to transform what we mean, go beyond the face-to-face experience, do things that you can't be done or be too expensive in a face-to-face setting. And I think the promise is definitely there, but it's been perhaps slower than anticipated in terms of, you know, I see more and more of a gap between the nature of the online experience in the entertainment world, say, and in the education world. And I'm never sure whether that's lack of funding, primarily nonprofit higher education, but you know, the for-profits with their huge market capitalization have, and some rhetoric, have yet to really demonstrate that that investment has turned into a qualitatively superior experience, or that all those analytics have revealed some nuances in terms of the pedagogy that they can affect that will somehow drive dramatic change. They still seem to me to be very much weighed down by their very non-traditional academically challenged population, and I think that's the far more fundamental challenge, regardless of delivery mode. I mean, delivery mode doesn't seem to be, it enables access, but is it really enabling? Is it really enabling? Getting to the finish line in either a more effective way, quicker way, more engaging way. I think the jury's still out. But again, we're probably asking too much of online to have solved those kind of massive challenges yet. But I think another decade, we can ask tougher questions of online.
Okay, Elaine.
I think one interesting thing that goes along with what Richard is saying is that we have asked about training. What kind of training do faculty get? And it's all over the map. Some schools provide their own. There is no real standard out there. There is no accrediting body. There's no way to measure. And as much as you have bad faculty in face-to-face classes, I'm quite sure you have bad faculty in online classes. And I think we need to do something about that in order to bring the quality and maybe some minimum standard to the students.
Do you want to ask your next question?
No, go ahead.
So I just want to maybe add to that a little bit. One of the things that we think is helpful in the paper is we bring a theory from disruptive innovation about business models, and argued that disruptive innovation has come to look at the business world and businesses through three distinct lenses. There are essentially only three really real kinds of businesses. One is a solution shop, and that type of organization tends to solve fairly unique problems. Gets paid whether or not it actually solves the problem in the end. Think of consulting companies. It's the expertise they bring to a particularly unique, novel problem. A value-added process shop, which basically takes a bunch of disorganized inputs and turn them into one output, like a manufacturing company does or a retail shop does. And then facilitated user network. Think of like a mutual insurance company, where it brings people together and, you deposit your money and then they connect that money to do investments to other people. And that one of the reasons that higher ed doesn't work and doesn't use online education very well is because it's a conflation of all three of those. It's like trying to combine the research function of a hospital with Whirlpool with McKinsey. And we have some analysis in the paper that suggests that adds to a lot of the overhead complexity in higher ed, but more importantly, it doesn't allow for the strategic use of online education. And I thought of it just now because of it all. I would argue that, what drives faculty not being trained to teach is the fact that most of the incentives are on the research function of the university, right? Not on the teaching function. Even in schools that primarily teach. Or say they do. The teaching, the research function still has all the incentives that support it and not the teaching function. And so in a setting like that, you introduce a set of tools like online education, and you don't have the business model, as we would argue in the paper, the organizational model, the value-producing model, to actually scale the use of that technology to make the instruction better, or the interest in doing it that way either.
Now, Elaine earlier mentioned this issue of accreditation, and I'm just wondering how each of our panelists feels about accreditation of online education.
Well, accreditation has, I think, in the early days, accreditation asked the question, well, is online sufficiently different than the mainstream that we need distinct standards? And there were in the early days some distinct, not standards so much, but set of guidance that all the accreditors agreed. Partly to deal with Western Governors University, which was a multi-state, multi-region non-profit creation to lever the power of online in the late 90s, and the conventional accreditation couldn't deal with it. But since then, I'd say accreditation has gradually come to the view that online, in terms of instructional good practice, bears a strong family resemblance to traditional higher education, and therefore the processes you need to oversee quality, and because most schools that offer online also offer on ground, and the two are blurring. So distinct standards, I think, quickly were pushed to one side. So in terms of the day-to-day accreditation oversight of higher education, I'd say there's more and more consciousness of online and less friction between the scale of online at school level and the background and attitudes of the visiting peers. There's been, I think, an interesting relationship between the department and the accreditors insofar as trying to use the accreditors as a way to tone down or manage some of the explosive growth that online has facilitated. So I think the ratio is any school that's growing more than 50% in terms of enrollment in any one year gets special attention. The only way they're doing that is through online delivery. So some interesting sort of backdoor attempts to try and work out how accreditors might better oversee online. The for-profit schools that have grown dramatically online have done so precisely through gaining regional accreditation, the benchmark that the most prestigious nonprofit schools have. So there's no friction there in terms of somehow online schools having a different accreditation. Historically, with forms of distance learning, that often was the case. But the great innovation, in a sense, on the for-profit side was to assume that top-tier accreditation mantle and not always therefore be judged as somehow second best. There are said to be differences between the accreditors as to how they view for-profit schools or view online, some more conservative, such as NEASC or WASC, some of the smaller regional accreditors, some more innovative, creative, whatever word you want to use, such as North Central. And I think North Central's been particularly on the back foot recently following some issues around American Intercontinental University online. But again, not so much to do with online, but to do with other aspects of their business model, but also questions around the purchase of failing nonprofit private schools under that accreditor and turning them into for-profit entities, and then, in most cases, growing them dramatically through online higher education, maintaining a small traditional campus, but then adding tens of thousands of online students in a very, very short space of time. And then questions have been asked about, well, did the accreditor anticipate that? Did they monitor it? Is that appropriate? And since over the last couple of years, that accreditor has been far more reticent about permitting those kinds of sales. But, you know, what the right policy is, what's the balance between those two, I think, has yet to emerge.
I think one thing you said that brings up the fact that there's not one accrediting agency, that there are many, many, many approved by the U.S. Department of Education that do accreditation. And some of them, and actually this week I found another one I'd never heard of. And they want you to come to their site because they'll tell you where you should take your classes. And I think that there is lack of standardization. And I also know that in some of the regional education boards, there is a movement to try and make it very difficult for something like the Western Governors to do any business in their states. I mean, for example, Georgia is in particular, has tried to keep them out of there because they do believe, and they're probably right, they're taking online students that might otherwise be going to their public or private nonprofits.
Lewis?
So, I mean, accreditation is still, in all its forms, and it's not standardized, it's still an inputs-based model. So if you have a certain set of inputs, you're more likely to get accredited. It's not really an outcomes-based approach to learning. We're only at the beginning of that if we, in fact, are going in that direction. So that's really what it is with all its flaws. It's true that the department, one of the things I found the most interesting in the last negotiated rulemaking, although I know that, the gainful employment rule is the much flashier topic, was the amount of pressure that the department was putting on accreditors in all of those, the succession of hearings. The department continued to ask them questions about quality. And at first, my sense was that the accreditors were, well, maybe we could do quality. And then once they started sinking in, what it would mean, they were like, well, we're not really quality organizations, right? And so we have to decide, and probably will in the next half decade to decade, if in fact we believe that the current system we have for some type of quality assurance, the membership-based voluntary accreditation process, if that is in fact the right mechanism for doing something that looks more like quality as an ROI measure for public money. I don't think we'd know that yet if that's what we want to use it for, if that's the best use of that particular mechanism that exists today. And there was one more thing that came to mind that I can't remember right now. So,
memory, it's one of the first things to go.
Yeah, exactly.
The issue of for-profit organizations has come up several times here, and I'm just curious what each of you think are the particular challenges in that area. I mean, Lewis, you mentioned that you thought for-profits were actually ahead on learning analytics, but yet on other measures in terms of student completion and paying back student loans, they don't do so well. So how do each of you assess what for-profits in particular are doing in online education?
Well, I can go first just to clarify. I said from what I've seen of their dashboards, the potential for learning analytics is there. So let me just clarify
that. That's fair enough.
Because there's an interesting thing, they invite, I've had some wonderful conversations, they invite an independent researcher in, and then there's only so much they'll show you because they view part of that political set of technology tools as proprietary, right? And so you can't see behind, it's kind of like the Wizard of Oz, don't look at the man behind the curtain, and so that's part of it. So what I've seen. Look, for the large publicly traded companies, one of the challenges has got to be that, to talk about business models, when enrollment drives the way Wall Street looks at your stock valuation, you're driven to recruit people, right? And I'm not saying that with a value statement. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying you're driven because that's what drives, senior management at a publicly traded company. And so that's one challenge. Another is something related to what Richard said, which is that, in the paper, we say that the for-profits look a lot like a disruptive innovator if you apply the lens of that theory from other sectors, from the software sector, from the steel industry, from airline transportation. But they haven't really, they've been moving through kind of like improving the functionality of the what was at first perceived as very low quality or low quality, improving functionality. The one thing that marks you as an incumbent, as a disruptor in a sector, is that you radically reduce the cost of given products in that sector. And that has not happened in higher ed yet with the for-profits. And so we leave an open question as to whether or not, in fact, they are the disruptor in the sector, or if not just an early upstart in the sector. In a contrast, you're starting to see folks, what we highlight Western Governors as someone else that has features of a disruptor in the sector with a fairly unique business model. You're seeing other players come on board like Straighter Line, the 99-cent, English course. And the one question there that I ask to audiences when I do these talks is, is geology 101 or psych 101 tradecraft? Is there a secret sauce to a professor sitting in front of 400 students that couldn't be put in a totally online setting? And we don't really ask that question in terms of business models in higher ed, right? It's all or nothing. We're still at the point where you're calling into question the sacred university which was put into motion 300 years ago in Bologna. We're not having a question about, well, wait a minute. Maybe there's 25% of what we do that could be done at a radically reduced price because it can't be more routine. And then in upper division courses, that's where you get more of the value add of quality faculty. And I don't see that kind of conversation happening at the for-profits either.
Okay. Elaine or Richard?
Actually, two things. One is... Jeff and I worked on a project for a large for-profit school, and their big question was, can we do something like U.S. News and World Report for our online schools? They were very conscious of the fact that there is no ranking system because you can find purported websites with ranking systems on them. However, I called every one of them, and they were pretty much yeah, you buy an ad, we'll raise you in the rankings. That was really what they, you know, no, we have, or we have students come and they vote online. So we don't have a clearinghouse that says, I ought to do this at Kaplan versus Western Governors. There's no way for us to do that. And in fact, it said to me that they feel they are different from the 85% of online learning students that are at our public and nonprofit schools. They are still not a huge part. They are growing faster, but they are still a minority of the online space. And the other was just last weekend. We were at the Education Writers Association, and the president of Kaplan was there. And he started his talk by talking about their on-the-ground schools. We are not just an online school. So there's clearly a defense there. They do not feel that they have come up to snuff. But on the other hand, they're spending money. And they are spending money both on infrastructure and a lot on trying to get students.
Richard?
I want to build on what Lewis said. I think it's certainly true that the for-profits so far have sent mixed signals about their potential to be a true disruptor. And the way they've been encouraged to describe themselves and judge success have been rather narrow and not very helpful in terms of them really, really demonstrating a broader impact. But I do think we're at an interesting moment for the for-profits. As many of you know, I think we are at the end of an era, in a sense, where we've now finally seen sufficient federal pushback on the for-profit model. I think it is the missing catalyst for spurring at least some of the more creative schools to try and achieve a step change in innovation and potentially move into a more creative area. So I think you could argue that the last 10, 15 years, we've seen a steady relaxation of regulation around admitting for-profits to regional accreditation. We saw the removal of the 50% rule, the 12-hour rule. We saw the safe harbors introduced after the 1992 Higher Education Act that allowed all kinds of connections between recruitment and payment to recruiters. And as a result, we saw dramatic increases in participation. Now, through the latest round of negotiated rulemaking, particularly in terms of the gainful employment rules, which only at any scale really apply to the for-profit schools alone, we've now, I think, and we're not quite sure what's going to happen and what the final rules will be, and it keeps being kicked a little bit further down the road. But my sense is the department's resolve is still there, and we are going to, in some kind of outcomes-based measure in terms of ability to pay back debt as a graduate, essentially relative to being able to find a job, some kind of measure that's not about how many students you enroll or how much money you make will start to become central to how for-profits are judged and have to judge themselves. And we're already seeing some interesting shifts. Some of the major firms are starting to slow enrollment, starting to forecast declines in enrollment, are starting to raise admission standards, starting to put in orientation processes. Not all of them are doing it. Some still are growing merrily and saying, they don't see any friction there. They stand by their quality at scale. But it's interesting that University of Phoenix, which has certainly was the pioneer of the most recent innovation of for-profit higher education away from mom and pop schools, vocational, non-degree, stretching back into U.S. history, but turning them into degree granting, regionally accredited, and so on. That school, I think, is at the forefront of that. And I wonder whether this is actually a very healthy intervention for the for-profits long-term. They feel the pain now, but I think this has been the missing kick, if you like, for them to really break out of a model that really only incented them to grow and add students and didn't really incent them to retain and really innovate in terms of the student experience and outcomes. But gainful employment, if it's done right, and maybe it's too mild, maybe they'll just have to adjust a few programs. The threshold's rather low, I think, arguably. So maybe it won't be sufficient, but I do feel that we're at this watershed moment where federal policy may stimulate this sector that arguably is dedicated to teaching, not focused on research, may actually take it to that next level and really have a sector that is judged, measured in terms of its contribution to the student experience and contribution to outputs. And if it can do that through that stimulus, then it's going to turn the for-profits into a far more formidable sector than they've currently been. But it's a big if still.
Okay, I have one more question, then I'm going to open the floor to comments from the audience. And the question is, I want to turn each of you into a czar, so you can actually make whatever policy recommendations you want. So if you were the czar, what would you do in terms of online education on any of the dimensions we've been talking about? And don't all of you speak at once.
Well, I've got one simple thing. I mean, I mentioned it earlier. I think if the department, as it's considering, but has been considering for some time, if the department could measure student success beyond first-time, full-time students, if it could capture every student, part-time, not first-time, graduate as well as undergraduate, online as well as face-to-face, if its tracking of higher education data could catch up, and it inevitably has to catch up. You know, innovation will always run ahead of statistics, but the gap is getting bigger, the tension's getting more problematic, and I think that notionally, relatively simple innovation would bring all of this innovation into the mainstream, into the light of day, enable comparisons and focuses on outputs as opposed to at the moment all we can track is, you know, how many students does University of Phoenix have, and it's very tricky to get any clarity on its output. So I think to me that's a simple but very powerful innovation that only the department could really affect, and it would drive all kinds of interesting change.
I've got good news. We've been talking to the Department of Education and hope to put ourselves out of business in 3 years that's their lead time to be measuring.
But do you really think it's going to happen? I know they've been saying this for some time.
I know. Well, you know, it was the first time they contacted us directly to use our definitions of what is online and what is face-to-face, because we have a standard definition that we apply that below 20% of technology in the classroom would be face-to-face, 20 to 80%. Would be blended, and above 80% would be totally online. And you're right. That would be, you know, there seems to be no reason why we can't track this somehow. And actually, that might, then what I would change would be the accreditation morass. I would really want to understand and have them all line up and tell me exactly what they're doing and have them standardize and do the same thing. What would you change?
I would do accreditation as well, make it more standard. There's some interesting work around the learning qualifications framework that the Lumina Foundation has recently introduced which I think has some promise. Also, I know this is going to sound a little bit, K through 12 of me, but a race to the top for a state that can deliver 60% of its baccalaureates in 3 years using online education. We need to start having conversations not around the four-year semester-based model for delivering education. We need to have those bigger conversations. Online is one way to get there.
Yeah.
In fact, the potency of online, and not just, the set of tools. I like the way you said that, Richard. Actually, that set of tools, the potency of that is going to be when you start playing around with the actual what you're delivering and how you believe you can deliver it. Can you get to the end goal by mixing this stuff up in a different way? That's what we propose in the paper. But you need to create incentives to actually try doing that.
Okay.
That's pretty interesting. We also study K through 12 and have done some, which is, eons behind online any place else. I mean, it's really only used for credit recovery and rural people that live in rural areas that can't take a course. But the idea that online is not for the 4 years, I think that would be a nice change.
Okay, let's open the floor to questions and comments. So just raise your hand. We have a question right here. If you could give us your name and your affiliation.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman. No affiliation now. My question is, I'd like to hear a little bit more about the blended. It would seem that if you use the blended to bring in expertise in teaching and expertise in subject matter, it would could greatly improve the quality of, because of the competition effect, even of the material taught in class.
We track blended, and it's about the same, growing very slowly. I would say maybe because it costs more even. You have to have all the things that are right for face-to-face and on-ground building, as well as all the technology.
Just to add to one, to go in a different direction from that. So in some ways, the reason we highlighted Western Governors in the as having a piece of the disruptive innovation pie was because disruptive innovation is the only place in the U.S., in the world for all I know, but maybe that's wrong. although I guess Carnegie Mellon's doing it now with the Open Learning Initiative, where technology does the teaching. So that's the big cost. That's what's the fact that cost isn't being reduced. So at Western Governors, the way they've actually set it up, you know, you have faculty as advisors and counselors, but you interact with technology, and technology does the teaching. And the Carnegie Mellon working on the Open Learning platform is doing something similar. And so, you know, you have this continuum of blended learning, but you run into the cost reduction problem, that it's not reducing the costs yet. And that isn't just because you can't reduce costs. That's because I would argue that the business model isn't designed for it. You don't have the kind of flexibility within the institution to just, for example, like move faculty around or downsize faculty and to make the blended work in a way that makes sense. But on the other side of that, we haven't fully really explored the robustness of what can the technology do in terms of the teaching, and then what new role does that create for faculty?
Blended is very interesting. We do a lot of research on that, and we've seen a persistent gap between what prospective students say they want more interest in blended versus actual supply from schools. And I do think it's because blended is complex. It occupies this amorphous middle ground between more or less on ground and more or less online, and few schools have really staked their claim to it. But I do think it's in most schools' interests to actually go down the blended path in certain respects, because I think if the future is more and more online and wholly online at program level, we don't need thousands of schools scattered by geography and assuming local participation. You know, what we really need is a relatively small number of high-quality, scaled providers who can, economies of scale and so on. So I think it's in most schools' interest to try and hang on, use online, or rather use blended, to hang on to local markets, stop the for-profits turning every local market into some corner of the national market. And at the moment, I think many, many nonprofits are a little confused as to whether online is their ticket to national status, international, which is less and less possible. Now we have hundreds and hundreds of schools offering pretty similar-sounding online programs. Or rather, really, it's about holding on to, you know, local adult markets. It's more and more of an alternative to regional centers around the state, that kind of thing. But I do think unless there's some aspect of your programming that does use the physical assets that you have that says those are still important, then, you know, why do we need all these schools? So I would argue that some sort of, I used to loosely call it 90-10, not to be confused with the for-profit 90-10, but 90-10 meaning 90% online, 10% on ground. And again, nonprofits tend to have an advantage. They tend to have, you know, broader campus assets, broader physical assets than the for-profits do. And some kind of very high-end, experiential, engaging, almost vacation-like on-campus experience where you leverage all the power of online, achieve some economies of scale, achieve some automated learning, cost reduction, but then hold on to something that connects you as a campus to your online innovation. Otherwise, I really think you've got the institution going in two different directions, and either the online will fall flat on its face and they'll lose that momentum, or the campus will start to wither because online implies that the campus is irrelevant. So I think blended is the future, but I think the blended has to be, you know, vast majority online, small proportion on ground. Otherwise, you lose all the costs and other benefits.
We actually, Richard and I and Jeff, have a report. Right. We wrote a report on blended. We can give you access to. We have the URL.
I actually have a question. What's interesting about that is, you know, early for-profit like Phoenix. Phoenix came, started adding campuses earlier on when he realized that if they put, you know, especially out west, if they put a campus or rented some space on the same off-ramp as an office park, right, they'd be able to get a lot of, do a lot of corporate business that way. And then you have this later kind of version of it that where, like, Kaplan is coming to this kind of a, they had this explosive growth online, and then they come a little bit later to adding the campuses. And what I've wondered, actually, is are they consciously trying to do what you just suggested, or is it a different adaptation, thinking that they need more of a of that on-ground profile because then it makes them look like the traditional model more?
Yeah, I think they're conflicted. I think there's some signs that the for-profit response to the current departmental pushback is to try and sound more traditional, which is ironic, but is in line with all prior institutional innovations, you know, teachers' colleges turning into four-year schools, turning into research universities. I mean, there's very much a pattern there. On the other hand, I think their investment in physical resources has typically been either a sort of an appendage to say, we've got this traditional campus, but, you know, that's not going to pay the rent. You know, we want everyone to go online, but it's good to have it to wave in front of the market. Or it's very basic facilities that arguably, I mean, I think Phoenix, more and more of their student body is now on the online campus and less is in the physical spaces. And the only problem they've encountered, I think, is when they launched Axia College, which was their two-year wholly online associate degree arm, which explosive growth really sort of rescued the institution in terms of momentum. But they found that I think they'd gone too low down the academic tier for wholly online to really work, and they turned back to their physical resources to provide additional retention support. But then that creates extra costs. And so I think it's – my assumption is online will get sophisticated enough that it can handle more and more of that retention burden, and the public will get more and more familiar with operating in that way throughout their lives. But right now, online's not quite there, so we're falling back on physical resources. But I have yet to see a for-profit invest in high-end physical resources as a strategic future direction. I think they're very much wedded to the scale through very, very lean resources.
Okay, we have a question over here.
Mr. Soares' disruptive innovation usually succeeds by identification of James Sang. Mr. Soares' disruptive innovation usually succeeds by identification of niches. Are there any top subjects or student populations that form niches which online advocates can point to where they've been successful? And also related to this, what has been the experience of the Defense Department in using online education?
Sure. So, yes, the way disrupt a key defining characteristic of disruptive innovation in a market is that initially it competes against non-consumption, right? And so, broadly, it's all the non-traditional students that a place like Phoenix serves, right? One of the questions that occurred to me, or observations that occurred to me when Richard was speaking last, was that, you know, a colleague of mine often says that, you know, one of the interesting things about the for-profits in this particular conversation we're having the last few years is that in some ways they just, because of, you know, the nature of being a for-profit company, they're just pointing out all of the ugly little dark places of higher ed that exist anyway, but they just, because of their business model is so much faster, it points it all out, like remediation. Remediation is an issue across all of higher ed. Even land-grant universities, maybe a lot of the flagships, but even land-grant universities. But it gets, because of the pace of enrollment and the speed of enrollment of that kind of student like Axia, it just becomes this massive, huge issue that becomes very clear. Defense Department. So one of the interesting things about Defense Department in online learning is that because they define, their learning objectives tend to be very, very explicit, right? You want someone to know how to fix this particular pump on this kind of tank. It allows them to design learning objects for a broad set of their perhaps, you know, high school grad level folks. So they have very specific tools in mind, very specific learning objectives they want. And I think that they have a lot of success there in online learning for that reason, actually. Very specific goals they're trying to achieve, very mission-driven goals in that sense. And that's where I think, from my exposure to that, where they've had a lot of success in terms of using online tools.
Okay, we have a question over here.
My name's Pete Guerin. I'm with a private foundation that invests a lot in education research. You know, some of the most eminent educational institutions in this area are going more and more to online learning. I know Johns Hopkins has a good bit of their master's programs in a number of areas that are delivered online. Have any of these great research institutions really looked at that product and tried to decide what works, how to make it better, evaluated it, compared it to on ground, to use your term? Some of these great is all the research going on in the outside world and the for-profit world, or are any of these eminent research institutions really looking at this and deciding what works and what doesn't work?
I mean, that's an interesting question. Most of the research that looks at this are, you know, it might be a very small study at Harvard, because Harvard where they will compare a face-to-face class with a non. And the problem is the selection bias. You can't really randomize the students into the class, and you find that, as Richard said, the students that are taking the online courses are fundamentally different than the ones that are taking the face-to-face. Although I would note that whether you take it face-to-face or in the classroom, you get a Harvard diploma. They don't differentiate and say, oh, yeah, but this guy took, you know, on your transcript. They don't differentiate. We actually, at Babson, tried to do this because all of our students come in. We're a business school. They all have to take a lot of accounting. We randomized the students. And then we had one which was a strictly blended class. And what we found at the end of the day, I guess, and I don't know if it's because we're mostly a residential campus, that the people that were taking it face-to-face were using the materials of the online students as well. So there's really this selection bias, and as well as you really end up with a hybrid group. It's the only school I know that has really done this is UNLV, where they have, in their writing classes, they have strictly online, strictly blended, and strictly face-to-face, where they have tried to randomize and said they see no difference. Same professor.
I mean, thus far there's been an inverse relationship between school prestige and willingness to move online. But there definitely are some exceptions to that. I mean, as was mentioned, Carnegie Mellon's Open Learning Initiative is perhaps the best example of a research-intensive institution applying all its wherewithal to this instructional problem and has put out some very compelling materials, and that initiative is at the heart of various federal and foundational efforts to try and scale this up. MIT's open courseware, arguably there's not that standardization element, but it's certainly a research-intensive institution emphasizing the value of online materials. You know, it's not saying how to use them, how to create them, but it's sending an interesting signal. I do think we're at the beginning of the elite schools taking online seriously and beginning to move online. For example, the tutor firm, number two, TOR, John Katzman, who made a lot of money at Princeton Review, is investing huge amounts in partnering with select high-end institutions, first University of Southern California, Georgetown, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, to offer exclusive, high-end, very high-priced, majority online, some sort of blended component programming. I'm a little skeptical as to the, you know, what's the value add exactly in terms of instruction. But there's a lot of compelling rhetoric. There's some interesting proprietary technology. They're trying to marry up the nature of the online student experience and the nature of the brand of the institution. So I think as those schools move online, again, it may just default down to brand, and it's hard to disentangle that as to what that really means. And I think we've certainly got, there's examples of that. But it would be, I think, the more prestigious schools will feel more and more comfortable playing online if they can point to deep value adds that are consistent with their brand. And at the moment, I think it's hard for them to do that. But that's the opportunity that allows them to embrace online without feeling conflicted.
Near the back.
Lydia Smino with the British Embassy. In this era when everybody's talking jobs, I'm just interested, is there any study or research, or have you got any feedback how the labor market is looking at distance education? How are employers looking at it for hiring purposes, particularly perhaps in a case where you have a student who has done majority of it, have gotten a degree from a completely online? How would the company look at? Do they value it more versus somebody, or value more somebody who has done traditional school or diploma? You mentioned how at Harvard, I guess, if you take a few courses, it doesn't necessarily appear in the transcript that you have taken. But for some others that are clearly online, have you got any information about that?
We've asked that question, and I would say schools that offer online say they don't see it being a problem. A lot of school, if you're a public institution and you offer the same thing online as you do in face-to-face, it won't matter because you will have a degree from that institution. But we have not looked at this because the sample of for-profit schools is so small, I can't give you the percent of them that have said that.
I'll just add, and this is just from last couple of years, I've spoken to both for-profit schools, the large, publicly traded ones, smaller mom-and-pops, and businesses in the regions where they are, just as part of my normal kind of work. And it seems to be very variable, You'll have, for example, in Hagerstown, Maryland, there was a school that was acquired by one of the large, it was a pre-existing mom-and-pop that was acquired by one of the large for-profits. And it did a lot of, paramedical administrative programming. And because it had been in that part of Maryland for almost 30 years, it actually had, and there was no community college in that region, it actually had a fairly good reputation among the employers in that region from just talking to them and asking at the Chamber of Commerce about their relationship. And then even some of the larger publicly traded companies, Chicago Metro, there's one large publicly traded company that has a fairly good reputation with hospitals in there in terms of a nursing program. But it does seem to be spotty in that way, like spiky almost, like in some ways you don't know anything about it. And then you find that it's, in some ways it's programs that have deeper roots in that particular area and connections in that way. And it doesn't necessarily say anything about my own instinct, because that's all it is that it doesn't say anything about the quality of the programming, except that they continue to hire those folks, right? It's not because anyone looked inside and said, this is good instructors. Oh, good student tracking. Oh, that's great. It's more that there seems to have been relationships built up over time.
And you, I think you've probably all seen the television ad where the person comes out and describes the job and said, and I'm a phoenix. Yeah. That clearly this is something they are trying to promote in their ads.
Okay, there's another question. Right there.
Ilyong Moon with the Fairfax County School Board. There has been very little comment on a distance learning on K through 12 education. If we could, some of you could comment more on how far K through 12 education can go with the distance learning.
We just have published our second report on it. It's and this one was just 9 through 12. This was just high schools. And it's very small. It's growing, but it's not, it's what, 1 million? I mean, you would know the numbers. About 1 million students taking online courses throughout. And this was all public schools in the U.S. So not a market yet.
And that's compared to about 5.6 in higher ed?
Yeah, 5.6.
Much smaller market, but
yeah,
much higher proportion.
Right. I mean, in higher ed, about 30% of all students have taken a course online. In K through 12, it's a fraction of 1%.
Okay, right up here up front.
How you doing? Reggie Smith, Chairman for the United States Distance Learning Association. I'm actually asking a question. What do you think associations can do to help fuel the balance that needs to take place for these markets to grow?
First, I think you could sponsor our survey.
Go!
Go!
Go, Elaine!
that. I mean, it's interesting because there are several. Some have chosen to, and I would say the Sloan Consortium, which we are sponsored by, we have been sponsored by the Sloan Foundation. We are not part of the Sloan Consortium. Tried at one time to have a clearinghouse of courses, which really doesn't work. I think it would be, I think it might be a place where you can take the lead in training of faculty. Or if not providing that kind of training, just getting out there that there are good ways to teach online and there are ways and there are other ways that if you're a good teacher in the classroom, that doesn't necessarily translate. And I think having that kind of strong message would be a good thing.
Okay, right there.
Jagdish Chandra, George Washington University. Two questions. How do you handle many of the subjects, experimental sciences, quantitative sciences, and so on? And two, how do you replace a good teacher?
And look, I can tell you that we have seen people that take, phlebotomy, drawing blood, online. Now, would you want that person taking your blood? Mm-hmm. Not so much. there's no control mechanism for what can be offered.
I mean, there are certain fields that are still essentially not online in any substantial sense. There might be supplementary theory-based courses that might be offered online, but there's still vast swathes of the disciplinary landscape that in higher ed that are not online and aren't going online anytime soon, in terms of the whole experience. But I think more and more of the experience will be technologically enabled. I think that's certainly the case.
Business and education, I guess?
The fields that have gone wholly online tend to be fields where there's no lab element or the participatory element between individuals is less about being in the same room. So the field of the range that moving online is gradually increasing, but there's still a lot that I think is going to remain resistant to wholly online for the foreseeable future.
I mean, simulation technology will change that a little bit, but I don't think you ever want it. I would still have someone actually have drawn some blood on somebody other than
me. And on the teacher point.
Brain surgery.
Yeah, no, exactly. But also, I mean, it really does really, it's not a conversation we're really having yet. Well, we had it at the beginning of the distance learning conversation like 15 years ago, really, when it was spurred by the Clinton administration. But what does the form of higher ed actually look like? What if you combined, a robust online platform in chemical engineering with co-op? And that became, over a 3 or 4 year period, that became how you get the baccalaureate in that space, right? We don't even have those conversations. And it's interesting, the gentleman that asked about prestigious universities, no one's having that kind of conversation. No one's saying, how do we fundamentally look at, what we want the outcome to be? And how do we move the different pieces around, including online ed, to get to that goal? And part of the reason is because, well, let's see. The state subsidizes you based on your enrollment. For the vast majority of students go to public schools. So you get attendance gets taken sometime in September and sometime in January. And as long as there's a butt in that chair, you get your subsidy. Doesn't matter if it's even the same butt. And so no one's asking these kinds of questions about how, given what we know about how you add value, the people, the technology, the processes that can yield a baccalaureate education, no one's asking the kinds of questions. Least of all, I mean, even the OLI at Carnegie Mellon, right, before it actually ramped up, there were certain agreements among the project and the faculty that it would not apply to certain aspects of Carnegie Mellon, right? And even though as they've been slowly kind of using their applied research methodology, kind of starting to figure out that, wow, a lot of different students can learn this way, and we can tell how they're learning and adapt the technology to teach them. Even as that has become obvious, there has been no expansion of it within Carnegie Mellon. And I'm not knocking them. I'm just suggesting that I often wonder if we are at, especially when writing this paper, if we are at this point where we're going to have that kind of fundamental conversation. about higher ed and how we deliver it.
Okay, right there on the aisle.
Yolanta Yushkevich, and I work for the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities. Two items. One, it's sort of ironic in terms of accreditation that the national accreditors, which are the ones that accredit for-profit schools, are the ones that actually have outcome measures. And when the for-profits seek out regional, it's ironic that they're actually getting away from the outcome measures. Just an observation. The second thing is when you talk about outcome measures and how important they are, and just disregarding what I just said about regional accreditation, I think it's important not only to deal with the data that are collected, and I strongly agree with you about the first time, full time, but it also has to do with the analysis. And a lot of what has been discussed is that a lot of the institutions, particularly the for-profit, are really educating a different kind of person, and also online a different kind of person in terms of their needs. So a person who is, you know, between 18 and 14 can readily go to a campus-based university and get that kind of education, but somebody who's older with family obligations is more likely to take online and also more likely to go to for-profit. So the issue here is why aren't we doing more analysis of similarly situated individuals? Why is it that we're comparing, you know, graduation rates, even if they were to be improved by the measure, of somebody who's gone to a prestigious institution, who has always been a high achiever, has gone to a selectively, you know, to an institution with selective admissions policy, comparing those kinds of people with those who are going to open admissions who don't have the kinds of resources and backgrounds? So wouldn't you agree that it's not only a question of looking at outcome measures in terms of standardized definitions, but also dealing with sort of how those data are going to be analyzed ultimately?
Yeah, I think that's very true. But and the reason why those kind of nuanced analyses can't really be done very often is precisely the missing data. So I think at the moment that's why we get all these odd comparisons being made between, yeah, you know, if we could, if you know, University of Phoenix, its full-time, first-time population is relatively modest proportion, but that's the only number we have, so let's put that out there. The demographic information on the student body is often quite limited. There's no information on graduate students at all. So, you know, policymakers, the media, make the best of what's there, but because what's there is so patchy, we end up with these, you know, very, very strange comparisons. So, yes, I think the benefit of what I was proposing earlier, a model that would take account of all students, all schools, and richer information on the students themselves would allow us to make meaningful comparisons.
Yeah. One of the conversations that, you know, we've both started with the department, but also as using this paper as a way to continue the conversation, we're doing a couple of convenings later this year, is that it's not just a question of expanding IPEDS. You know, in terms of regulatory policy, we made a choice in various reauthorizations of the Higher Ed Act to move more to a consumer information model of how we're trying to help make better choices about college selection. Each version of the Higher Ed Act in the last 15 years has added more components of consumer information. And in fact, with the current department, it's the first time in a while that we've gone in another direction where it's more the regulatory, the regulators coming at it,
yeah,
right? It's been,
yeah,
consumer information. It's been a while since we've done that. And I actually think that we will continue to use the consumer information, not the least of which is because it's less expensive than more it costs the department money to regulate. And I think we actually need a different way of thinking about, as we've gradually expanded access to college since the GI Bill, there's a diversity of learners that we would now consider post-secondary learners that we never even anticipated. The traditional, non-traditional categories in IPEDS don't even come to really understand that mix. We actually need to come up with a handful of different categories for the way people actually consume college. How does this person consume college? This, you know, working 45-year-old, right? This, you know, part-time working 22-year-old. How do they actually consume? How are they likely to consume college? And develop data categories around those three. We're bringing together some folks from the higher ed data side and some folks from the business marketing side, actually later on this year, to have that conversation. I think that that's when, and it's basically looking at higher ed as a consumer-driven market and not as a third-party payer-driven market, which is largely the way we think of it now, right?
Right.
So states pay for it, federal government pays for it.
Okay, right here, we have a question.
Hi, I'm Daniela Fairchild from the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Noting that K-12 education hasn't made a lot of progress in the online learning front, what are some lessons that K-12 can learn from higher ed, can pull?
Great question. I would say that one unique problem in K-12 is school boards and budgets. I think that there would have to be much expanded planning in that regard. But back in the dot-com bubble, there were businesses that were ramping up that thought they could deliver this. And then they realized that they were going to have to go to every single school board to try to get, and they flamed out beautifully. I mean, I think that there needs to be a lot more forethought in terms of how this can be achieved.
Yeah, and I do think the freedom of action that for-profit schools have had in higher ed, there's nothing comparable in K-12. And if you take that for-profit energy out of higher ed over the last 10 years, online wouldn't have grown in the way that it has, wouldn't be as visible as it has. So I really think that's the missing catalyst. And it's hard, and it, you know, there are still vendors, you know, doing their best in K-12, but it's complicated.
Right there is a question.
Hi, Celeste Riendo with the Institute of International Education. I'm just curious if there's any indication of an international student market for American distance education, being that it can actually be distance education and people don't necessarily need to be within 50 miles of the school they attend. So if you could speak to that at all, and if there's any initiative to export American education to other countries through distance learning.
It's certainly been...
Tiny. Yeah, I mean, I think... I would say we have more success educating our military on the ground in foreign countries. We see about 15% of schools that offer distance education are offering it to the uniformed services. But no.
I mean, so American Public University was such a lot of work with the military. They actually do active duty online training, but to your point, it's folks on the ground there. The for-profit sector is growing internationally. I mean, in Brazil, there are a couple of the larger publicly traded companies that are growing quite dramatically, but I don't think it's actually their online offering. I think they're building actual facilities to do face-to-face there.
Right.
I think in terms of acceptance of online in higher ed, the U.S. is the most advanced, if you want to put it that way. And the for-profits over the last decade in the U.S. have definitely tried. They've invested. They've created new entities. They've partnered. They bought things. And on the online side, it's been very, very lackluster. Where there's been much more success is buying bricks and mortar institutions, transforming them, investing in them, standardizing. That's been very successful. But I do think, for all the reasons that in the U.S. online has taken off, and as Lewis said, in some countries, the domestic for-profit system is taking off. But I don't know if it's taking off on a scale that's been such an important catalyst in this country. So there's definitely capacity challenges overseas. There's you know, the on-ground can't cope. There's lots of cross-border on-ground provision, as well as students coming to the U.S. or coming to the U.K. or Australia. And more of that is blended. So I think we're beginning to see signs of more of a stronger online role, but wholly online, never coming to this country, the school never having to leave this country, you know, apart from a tiny slice of very high-end elite MBA type stuff, it's still this horizon, and I just think it's going to be very difficult to make a strong case for that. But there are still schools trying. I think the more crowded the domestic market gets in the U.S., with regard to online, the more interesting and promising international markets get. But every effort so far on the wholly online end has been tentative, experimental, small scale, and many have failed. But I do think we'll gradually see more momentum going forward.
One of the key drivers, I think, of the growth of online education broadly, I just want to come back to this because no one asked this question, is going to be our level of comfort and how good our assessments are on measuring competencies. And I just want to add to that, Phil Oswald, who's at George Mason University, does some writing and has been doing some writing recently about the global companies that are starting to look beyond credentials and looking at competencies that people have, because they're recruiting globally, and they're starting to realize that there are a lot of inefficiencies to depending just on credentials. And to recruit, they think project in terms of the work that they do, and they're looking for competencies and people that have sets of competencies. And before, they would basically, you know, I want someone who has business skills and has design skills, so they recruit someone who has an MBA and an MFA. And they realize there's an inefficiency there, and they're starting to look for certain competencies. There are very few companies that are very sophisticated at this. Some of the large consultancies are. Boeing has actually developed an internal system where they map their performance metrics for someone on the job back to the school they went to and the courses they took. It's fairly sophisticated. They've started talking to companies about this. They've been doing it about 7 years. As that market for competencies evolves and grows, online education that has competencies attached to it is going to become more powerful. It's a very interesting way, because part of what's missing is if you actually can build into an online tool like Western Governors does, right? You say, okay, I have competencies that I want people to achieve. It means that those competencies means they can do things in the real world. You start unlocking what a lot of folks expect, you know, if you sit, especially at the undergraduate level, you sit someplace for 4 years on a residential campus, you take in stuff by osmosis by being there, right? Whatever the quality of the pedagogy. And if we can start getting to people believing that that competency measurement and the assessments that measure those competencies actually mean you can do things outside, then online learning that can incorporate that, like the OLI is an early version of, and what Western Governors claims to be able to do, online learning ends up being able to grow in a whole different way than we think of now. Right now, the sheepskin effect that comes with the baccalaureate or even an associate, more with the gold standard, the baccalaureate in the U.S. anyway, that's very hard to surmount. We don't have the assessments. The psychometricians will say we just don't have the assessments that can measure the individual competencies. That's a real trigger here, I think. If we actually get better at competency assessment and people believe that those competencies mean folks can do things outside of the academic setting, that gives online learning a whole different place to grow.
Okay, I think we will end on that note, but I want to thank Elaine and Lewis and Richard for sharing your views with us, and thank you all for turning out.